Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
May 3rd, 2017, episode 109, The View from Space. Working hard or hardly working? It's been a mix of long nights and nights where I'm kind of out of gas, and even still, I've been trudging downstairs to my little basement man cave and working at massaging the episode that comes this go-around. Hi everyone, this is Kevin England, and I'll welcome you to our latest effort, one that's a little behind schedule, but it's here nonetheless. There may be a few bumps in the road to our regular release cadence every once in a while, but I'm committed to catching up and staying on the schedule of something at least every 2 weeks. Even if I fall behind, I'm looking to release our next episode this weekend. I'm recording this on a Wednesday night, so by Sunday night, we'll be back on schedule. So you'll get bookend episodes with the expectation that after this weekend, we'll be back on our regular schedule 2 weeks from this Sunday. You see, once in a while it takes me a little more than anticipated to dig in on a topic, and sometimes I don't like what I prep and push it aside as it's not quite where I need it to be. And such is the case on the delays for this go-around. I had an alternate article or two published ready to go for this episode, but I didn't quite like the way it was developing and had to do some additional research. So it took me a while to build some stand-ins, but I'll have those other pieces ready for next go-around. Still, I think you're going to get by with what we have, so let me quick jabbering and tell you what we have in store, and then we'll dive right into the episode. First up, glyphosate impacts. Glyphosate is commonly known by its trade name Roundup, and I'm going to share some research about its impact to honeybees, specifically research that has found it to impact honeybee appetite behavior. I don't like that word. Segment 2 is a far-out review of a way to put your mind at work, and all related to beekeeping. Roundtable 1, honey production without bees. Roundtable 2 is about being industrious. Roundtable 3 is a twist on agriculture and honeybee health. And toward the end, we'll close out with some news and notes if we could fit it in. But first, let's hit the local hive report. Local hive report. This is about as local as it gets. I'm literally standing out here in the apiary. I'll start with the first hive. You know, I wanted to say the last couple days it's been hot in New Jersey in the 80s, but today it was only 65 degrees. Last weekend I took the chance to split the Gateway hive. I looked in and it was loaded with resources and it looked really good. I took eggs out and put them in the 8-frame hive that did not survive. That hive was 161 pounds with 3 boxes. I pulled 5 frames out of it and put it in there and made a mini nuke in the 8-frame. And then in the 8-frame, which is sitting on pad number 3, I pulled a couple excess frames of honey and pollen that I had from my nukes that I tried to overwinter and put them in there. So looking at this box, when I finished, I'm talking about back to the Gateway hive, it's 3 deeps, and I put a honey super on top. And I look at it today, it was 161 when it started the year. It's sitting at 187 pounds. And this hive is just going to town. It's really doing well. I'm hoping I thwarted it from swarming, from making that split. And if I go back here to the 8-frame, I found the queen cell, and I think we're good to go. It will make a queen, and I'm excited that this hive is going to do well. In the meantime, that hive is really flying well and getting a lot of resources. Now, as I wander over here to pad number 1, there's a nuke box sitting on here. And if I look at pad number four, there's two nuke boxes. These are five-frame nukes. They came courtesy of Bob Kloss. Bob was going through a bunch of inventory that he has. He's got all the hives he needs. And when he has access, he was able to give me a couple to help make up for the nukes that didn't overwinter. So I gave him my queen castle last week in case he had some extra supplies. And my queen castle is a 10-frame box with two slits in the middle. And it's able to hold three frames, and that's what he gave me back. Each of the three frames was loaded with bees and resources, and each of the chambers had a queen cell. So on Friday, I picked up the queen castle that he had loaded with resources, and I split them up. Today is Sunday, and I went through them, and all three of them look like they're in reasonable shape. The first one, the queen is emerged, and the hive has plenty of resources and bees. She doesn't look like she's mated yet. She's still relatively small, but it looks like in good shape. The second nuke looks really good too. Plenty of bees, plenty of resources, and it found the queen in the same way. In the third one, there was only two frames of bees. There were no bees in this box. When I loaded it, it was loaded, but I knew that a lot of bees were up in the air when I had done that split, and I think a lot of them flew over here to this 8-frame box that's on pad number 3. So today, I even the score. I took several frames out of the 8-frame and dumped them back into that hive and then watched, and some of them left and went back, but most of them stayed there. So my guess is they're back to 3 frames of bees. Now, I looked through that box with huge amount of scrutiny, and darn if I couldn't find a queen. And there weren't a lot of bees in it, but the entire time while I was looking through, I saw bees that were tail up in the air with the Nazanov gland, which leads me to believe that they think there's a queen in there. I'm not convinced, and I'm going to let it ride, and I will go look. But there's certainly no queen cells available, so if there was a queen cell in that, it hatched. If not, I'm not sure what's going on, and it's one of the ones to watch. So nuke 1, good. Nuke 2, good. Nuke 3, not really. But we'll see if I'm wrong. Gateway hive is 3 deeps and a medium, and it's doing great. And the 8-frame looks pretty good, too, so it's supposed to be really, really warm, good resources out right now, so I think all these hives will thrive. Now, here's the news that's all the news. Last weekend, I went to the farm, and I pulled all the hives, and I brought them back home. You know, it's easier for me to get the resources and take care of the hives when they're here. And, you know, all through evaluating over the winter, I really liked that location over there, but every time I went over there, it was a pain. I'd forget something, I need something, I'd do whatever. Even as much planning as I do, I just didn't get the vibe over there. The other unfortunate thing that happened, and this is just a tragedy, is that the homeowner passed away. I've known her for a long time. She had an illness. I knew she wasn't doing well, but unexpectedly she passed away and we went to her services. So we dedicate this episode to her, Margaret. She will be missed. I spent a lot of years with Margaret running the rescue squad. That's how I knew her. Night calls and just terrible that has happened. That really has nothing to do with why I brought my bees home. Why I brought them home is specifically what happened today. I got in them and I didn't have to drive over there and load up. And the other thing that was really tough is just mowing the grass over there has been such a challenge. I don't have an easy way to load a tractor up. There was a lot of grass and it's a lot easier. So last weekend, I went and cleared an area for my hives. In the farthest corner where I wanted to set up an apiary. I've never been down here before on my property. But the thing is, when the sun rises in the morning and comes up over the trees, it hits this far corner of the field
where I have these bees, and they'll get to work earlier. So I think it's a far better location for bees. Now, looking at what I have going on here, I have the polystyrene hive at home now. And what I did was I cleared a flat piece of land, and Sharon had these little mats. I'll call them mats. They're made out of bamboo. They're about 3 by 6, and I have each of the hives sitting on those on a dirt flat part. And it's on a level ground. I had to step it a little bit so that the hives were level, and I still think the hives probably aren't right. They're tilting back a little bit so that if water hits the landing board, it's going to roll into the hive. I got a little work to do to adjust, but what I really want to do with these at some point is put some concrete pads underneath like I have for the location I was just at. So while I've been telling you what's changed, I walked over and I'm standing here staring at these hives. So the polystyrene hive, about an hour ago, I went through it. It has 2 deep boxes and 1 medium that it came out of winter, and it's just absolutely loaded with bees. Now, the funny thing is when I brought it over here, it seemed really, really light to me, and it doesn't have a ton of resources. The unfortunate thing is the all medium hive that was alive a couple weeks ago, we had a cold snap just prior, after that last episode I recorded, and that hive was not very strong. And it didn't make it through. I am absolutely astonished that that hive did not make it through. That hive was 5 boxes deep, solid bees going through into winter. And it was flying up until about 2 weeks ago. Now, I don't know if I'm wrong, and maybe it was being robbed and I wasn't paying attention. But when I went and looked at it in January, February, and early March, I saw pollen going in and out. There wasn't a huge cluster when I broke it apart, which means it was just making it through. And if it had turned warm in a normal stance in New Jersey, it probably would have made it through. But that last little snap of cold was the one that did it in. And it just sucks. So I took 2 of the mediums that had capped honey from me feeding that hive over winter, and I put them on these other hives. So the poly has 2 deeps in the regular poly medium that it came through with. And then on top of it is the food from one of the mediums. I really only put it on this hive so that it would be protected. I don't intend to go there. And in fact, this hive is hammering and has so many bees at this point that it really needs to be supered. Now, I thought it would swarm, so I started looking through it and I found queen cells in it, capped queen cells. And so I made a split of it. That's what I did about an hour ago. I pulled them out and I put them in a nuke. So I pulled 3 frames loaded with bees and a queen cell, and I put it in amongst some reserves that I had from other hives. And now I have a 5-frame nuke sitting on one of the hive stands here. So the other hive, I haven't done a thing with it. I know this hive is really in good shape. I could see a ton of activity from it. It's the package hive from last year. It's 2 deeps and 2 mediums. One of the medium came from the medium hive, and this hive is hammering away. If I don't do something with it, my guess is it will probably swarm. So one of these nights this week, it's supposed to be 80 degrees and it's been sunny till about 7:30. I'll probably break it apart. I'd like to do it today, but the sun is just about to set, and that's not going to work. So, local hive report, wow. A lot of stuff going on. I'm standing here in this field and I'm looking through and I see all of the yellow wild mustard. And the other thing that I see is dead nettle is all over, and the bees were all over this in this field. So I'm really happy that this person didn't carve this field up, and I'm hoping they give me at least 1 more week of forage here to keep my bees going. And given that it's a work week and I know who he is and what he does, I don't think he'll be in during the week. He usually only comes in on the weekend, so I think I'm safe for another week of forage, which is perfect. All right, that's it. Local hive report, check. Let's go to segment number 1. Segment number 1 called GLY. I'm going to venture down a path that is fraught with peril at the beginning of this segment. I want to talk about something that is somewhat personal to me. In fact,
It is literally something I come into direct contact with. I have alluded to this segment a few times, and I've been wrestling on how to broach it, as I want to have a balanced approach. Personally, I have my opinions on how glyphosate scares me. Glyphosate is a Monsanto product commonly known as Roundup, and well, they spray it on the field upstream of me every year, and common sense would suggest that when it rains, the probability is that its residues run downhill into my property. Or, likely true at minimum, it's in the soil that surrounds the fields adjacent to my property. I have an article in the queue about the impacts of glyphosate on bees, and I've been holding it because I wanted to take the time to read and digest it so I was fair in reporting on it. I sense that it's a polarizing topic, and there's a sentence in the second statement of the journal article that states, quote, "The sublethal impact of GLY on non-target organisms, such as insect pollinators, has not yet been evaluated," end quote. That statement simply has me scratching my head. How? How can glyphosate, which is used far and wide in Roundup ready crops, not have been tested? At minimum, the sheer use of it in the U.S. would suggest that, while perhaps researchers may not have a dedicated study, insects and Roundup, along with Roundup ready plants, have been interacting year after year, and researchers have been studying bees from the real world in earnest since CCD came about, and if some link were out there, I would have think that it would have been come in some finding or conclusion by now. The fact of the matter is I've heard anecdotally that bees have had Roundup applied directly to them, meaning somebody sprayed them by mistake, thought they were spraying sugar water, but sprayed Roundup. And while it had some impact, it didn't kill the colony outright. So you have to wonder. But still, research is research. And like I said, I sit here with this research paper that has insights into the impacts, and I simply can't ignore it. So I'll share it and let you be the judge of the findings. I should say that the lead-in makes me feel as if I don't trust scientists' conclusions. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I applaud the research and I appreciate that it was conducted. It's, in my estimation, one piece of data and will only stand up with other data in aggregate that either support or refutes it. I simply think the best way to consider this stuff, no matter what the source, is to catalog it and add it up into a data bank and then in time make the judgments. That being said, I have a cautious feeling about Roundup. Not because I have evidence that it's a problem. No, it's more that if someday it is found to be a definitive problem, boy, are we in trouble given its pervasive nature. How pervasive? Here's some human-based snippets from a review published in the journal Environmental Health 2016. From a journal article, "Concerns over use of glyphosate-based herbicides and risks associated with exposures, a consensus statement." This was published February 17, 2017, and it shares some of these facts. Mind you, it's talking about the impacts to humans and mammals in general, but I'm going to draw a connection to honeybees in a few moments. With another study, the one that I alluded to. So Roundup has been available since the late 1970s and was sold to farmers beginning in 1974. Since then, it has increased in volume approximately 100-fold. By 2014, annual farm sector glyphosate usage increased to approximately 240 million pounds based on data from the USDA, USGS, and the EPA, and is commonly used on corn, soy grain, canola, wheat, barley, and edible beans, among other things. Considering impacts to humans, the WHO, World Health Organization has classified it as a carcinogen, and there are associations with B-cell lymphoma, and there are concerns of occupational exposure. To the common layperson, you probably don't come into contact enough with it to encounter those exposures, and there is, according to the WHO, unlikely carcinogenic risk to humans through diet. But persistence is called into question. Early assumptions about glyphosate, for example, that it is not persistent in the environment, have also been called into question depending upon the soil type. In addition to soil impact, there was a prediction that glyphosate would never be present widely in surface water, rainfall, or groundwater, but that has also been shown to be inaccurate. With those few items covered, let me turn to the bee research. So bee research. The journal article about beekeeping that I referred to earlier has been published by the Company of Biologists Limited, the Journal of Experimental Biology, 2014, issue 217, pages 3457 to 3464. The article, entitled Effects of Field Realistic Doses of Glyphosate on Honeybees' Appetitive Behavior, was produced by Lucila T. Herbert, Diego E. Vasquez, Andreas Arenas, and Walter M. Farina. The premise of the research was to determine if field realistic doses of glyphosate had any impact to bees. They surmised that since it is so widespread in use, and it is most commonly applied by aerial application, which along with other methods create drift, that exposure could be to target and non-target application, and they wanted to know what effects, if any, it had on non-target organisms. In the case of the bees, because they forage multiple times a day, they are of course subject to exposure to plants that have been treated and can come into direct contact or incidental contact via plant materials they bring back to the hives. Of course, we're talking about nectar here. Glyphosate is known to be present in the flowers that are visited after spray application, and glyphosate has a high solubility in water. The study states, quote, "Substances that are taken into the hive can remain stored for long periods of time and accumulate until the resources are used as supplies for the colony. Hence, agrochemicals accumulated inside the hive could have a subtle negative effect, often inconspicuous within the short term, that could impair behavioral processes in the long term." End quote. So what they tested? They looked at survival, ingestion, and locomotive activity measured at 15 days of age for bees exposed to different levels of glyphosate to begin with. So quick note, it's likely I'm going to say glyphosate tons of times in this episode, in this segment, so let me take a shortcut on something. Scientists referred to the product as GLY, and for brevity purposes, I'm going to use that too. So, while they took a look at survival and locomotive activity, in this case, they informed that they did not see higher than normal levels of survivability with the sublethal doses when compared to untreated bees. They also did not see differences in food intake and behavioral responses such as locomotive activity. So what's the problem? 15-day-old bees eat, move, and they survive all kind of the same as the control bees not fed GLY. Well, of course, there's more to the story. In bee research, you might see videos of gustatory response clips. If you've ever watched clips of how honeybees are tested during a CCD video or one ilk or another, the clip looks like this. A bee is held in a vise device, and it is provided something to eat, and it extends its proboscis, looking like a pet sticking its tongue out to lick a lollipop. I'm telling you this because the research that I'm about to explain to you uses this technique to test some of the bees. The reward system is part of a PER and gustatory response protocol. PER is the proboscis extension response. Did the bee think there was going to be a reward and therefore extend its proboscis? And gustatory is defined as being concerned with tasting or the senses of taste. So in time, they have figured out that bees will stick their tongue out if they feel there's a reward. And they do this both for the taste and for the smell. Kevin moment. This approach seems odd, and therefore these clips always stand out to me, but they're pretty common in coverage on bee research, which is why I said that. If you've ever seen scientists in the lab, they're strapped in some contraption and made to stick out their proboscis for food. To me, it seemed inherently cruel. I never really liked it. I know it's a useful research tool, but if they're were a don't test on animals moment for me, it's every time I see a bee constrained for testing, my toes curl. I guess all for science, I suppose. End of Kevin moment. So it's here that the research of GLY becomes interesting. For this PER, gustatory testing, is a known way to measure the bee's association with odors and tastes. It appears they conducted this research in stages and planned the evolution of testing and the impacts of GLY by building one test segment leading to another. And that'll become evident as I tell you how the research went. So the first stage was lab testing of taste and odor. In the gustatory, or as a reminder, taste response, when comparing against a control and fed with food that had GLY in it, they rated this on a scale of 2 to 5. When they were fed solutions that contained GLY, the results were lower with the concentration of 2.5 milligrams rating, a 1 to 3 ability range, and the 5 milligram rating matching that, and it was also 1 to 3. The takeaway here is that with GLY present, there was a diminished taste response in contrast to just plain sugar water or whatever they used as the control. So the contrast was 1 to 3 for 2.5 milligram and 5 milligram, and the control, the taste ability of the bee ranged from 2 to 5, meaning they could have a better sense of taste. The research stated, and I'm paraphrasing, but I'm really close to what their statement was, gustatory response scores of bees exposed to GLY were lower than those of non-exposed bees. This indicates that 15-day-old bees that were reared with sublethal concentrations of GLY present an increased response threshold for sucrose. So again, as far as taste goes, I'm taking the results to mean that bees that have GLY present seem to have a diminished sense of taste, or as they labeled it, a lower gustatory responsiveness. So far we've talked about taste. Let's switch to their ability to detect an odor. From what I gather, and this got a little tricky, they tested the bees for the ability to detect a concoction referred to as a CS, or conditioned stimulus. They mixed different formulas of chemicals that they could train the bees for detecting and then determine if a control produced a different proboscis extension response when GLY was added. In the test for bees 15 days old, the three trials done with linalool as the additive for the proboscis extension response. According to Wikipedia, linalool, N-I-N-A-L-O-O-L is how it's spelled, refers to two enantiomers of a naturally occurring terpene alcohol found in many flowers and spice plants. Enantiomers are defined as each pair of molecules that are mirror images of each other, according to Wikipedia. So how did it turn out? For recognition and reward, when GLY was present in the food, they indicated their words. The results show that prolonged exposure to sublethal concentrations of GLY during the first 15 days of adult life hinders the acquisition dynamics of the ability to establish an association between the odor and the reward. So in the case of taste and odor, GLY being present diminished for both. Now I said they did these in stages. Let me go to the next stage. The previous bees, 15, were raised in laboratory settings. And it should not be missed that the age of these bees is during the first 15 days of the adult life. And one could surmise that the first 15 days of a bee's in typical circumstances would be inside the hive and not foraging. This means the exposure they would get to GLY would be from what bees bring back, and subsequently this food is laced with GLY and would be passed to the offspring. Want us to think, well, what about the bees that are foraging? What's the impact to them as they're getting exposed to it in the field? In the next stage, the scientists switched tactics and collected bees from an operational hive at the hive entrance. And this would mean they were using real forager-aged bees. They specifically wanted to test the effect of acute exposure to GLY on hive-reared bees. Elementary olfactory learning. We'll find out what that means in a second. They sensed right away that there was a lower PER towards the conditioned stimulant that remained through the rest of the bees they tested. After success with the CS using linalool, they switched the formulation to what they referred to as a non-elementary PER conditioning assay. So they used linalool with the bees that were foraging, and the second test through 8, I think that was the number, I'm doing that one through memory, indicated a lower response with the forager bees. Just want to make sure I didn't go too fast through that. Now what they did was switch the product to non-elemental. And I have to be honest and say, I don't know why, but I surmise they wanted to change the stimulus concoction for some reason. And it appears they adjusted the conditioning stimulant with different ingredients, including a product called limonene, spelled L-I-M-O-N-E-N-E. It's a chemical that I'm guessing they use because it provides a citrus-like smell, as it's said to possess a strong smell akin to oranges. So if I got this right, and again, I said that the research was a little tricky to follow, it seems like they used linalool, and now they're switching to limonene as the product to stimulate the bees. Still using bees that are foraging age, not bees in a laboratory experiment. Following it? Good, good. The outcome was that acute exposure to sublethal GLY impaired the proboscis extension response of the foragers after testing. They used 32 bees in this one that were once again a finding that an acute exposure to sublethal GLY concentration impairs non-elemental learning abilities of hive-reared bees. So in the second response where they did non-elemental learning, same result. Diminished PER, and PER is proboscis extension response, which is where they were expecting something and they would stick their proboscis out. So to be thorough with this, there was one more round of experiments that was conducted to see if bees fed a solution of GLY would impact their ability for foraging related behavior. The outcome of this was GLY or no GLY. Visits to the feeders that they had remained steady and foraging cycles remained consistent. And it didn't matter whether GLY was present or not. The researchers also wanted to see if there was an impact to waggle dance routines. So they went inside the hives of the returning foragers. And to that end, they did not find any discrepancies there either. Meaning, some feeders they fed GLY, and then they watched those hives, and some they did not, and they watched the hives, and no difference between the dancing. So I think I've worn this out enough. As is customary with research paper, there was discussion and conclusion sections at the end. I'm going to provide a few passages from the discussion that sums up somewhat what I covered, but in their words. These are all direct quotes out of the research paper. First one, we set out to evaluate the effects of chronic and acute exposures to field-realistic doses of GLY, the main herbicide currently used for weed control in agriculture, on behavior of the honeybee Apis mellifera. Our results show that both chronic and acute exposures to GLY traces produce sensory sensitivity and cognitive deficits on adult honeybees in the worker caste. The concentrations used, and in parentheses it says within 0 to 3.7 milligrams, were based on concentrations recommended for spraying and on those measured in natural environments. Young adult bees chronically exposed to concentrations of 2.5 and 5 milligrams of GLY showed reduced sensitivity to sucrose, in parentheses reward, and impaired acquisition dynamics during elemental associative olfactory learning. An acute exposure to GLY in a foraging context did not have a detrimental effect on foraging activity and dancing behavior. I'm going to jump ahead here, but I found an interesting little snippet in their conclusion that I had considered. It said, because no effect on foraging activity was found, successful forager bees can become a source of inflow of nectar with GLY traces into the hive, which in turn could have long-term negative consequence to colony survival. So let's stop on that one for a second, and that's an interesting notion. It doesn't impact the bees out in the field, so therefore they bring it back to the hive. If they had some sort of impact out in the field, maybe this could be stopped there. But the fact that there is no impact in the field means it makes it all the way into the hive. That's an interesting notion. I hadn't thought about that. That was a Kevin moment, by the way. End of Kevin moment. So toward the conclusions, I would say this is what they had to offer. Our results have shown that the presence of sublethal concentrations of GLY in this context has the following consequences. 1. A lower sensitivity to reward. 2. The formation of weak associative memories that can be extinguished rapidly. And 3. A difficulty in establishing non-elemental associations. These difficulties in establishing associative memories would, in turn, make the gathering of resources inefficient. However, our results have shown that foraging behavior is not immediately affected by the presence of GLY in the food source. Therefore, these same forager bees become vectors of the herbicide that is taken back to the hive, disseminated between the individuals of the hive, and stored in their reserves for long periods of time. Wow. Interesting. It's one of those things that make you think and say, what does this mean? And you have to kind of just evaluate all the statements and wonder where this takes us. The paper in itself concluded that it's one of the first of its kind, and like any research, it opens ideas that there are a number of avenues one could follow to consider and explore in order to understand the impacts of glyphosate, if any, in the ecosystem. As it is, while I was doing this research, I found another article about glyphosate that indicates it has additional impacts to honeybees. It's just going to be fascinating to see if there are a run of research articles to come on glyphosate, pro or con, in the future. And I'll leave it at that. If you're interested in the resources that are used for this segment, you can visit our show notes. Show 109. It'll be segment number one. Segment number two, I call this one The View from Space. I woke up in the middle of the night with my mind racing on a number of work challenges the other night, and I started to work my way through some things so I could put my mind at ease and hopefully go back to sleep. As I was going through the troubles of the day that were keeping me awake in the middle of the night, I recognized the answer for one of them. And truth be told, I had asked myself to consider that notion before I went to bed. And I'm going to share this really strange thing with you that I never thought to share, but I think now is an interesting time. So I want to talk about this thing that I do, but before I do, a short disclaimer. I know how it's going to sound. Please don't think me a nutter for what I'm about to disclose. Simply hear me out and consider the notion that what I'm going to tell you is possible, and if you're interested, you could search out some research that's out there that says what I do works. Or simply, you could take my word for it, and you could be blessed and cursed like I am. I have found early on in life that if I have a problem, I can use my brain power to solve it in a unique way. This is going to sound a bit like some self-help guy, maybe Tony Robbins, but this is what I do. As I lay down at night and just before I fall asleep, in that short calm before you finally doze off, I evaluate a problem and all the things I know about it. I use my inner voice to walk through all the details, and in the end I talk with myself and make a request of my brain to work it out and give me an answer in the morning if possible. That last part is kind of a funny thing. And I don't know why it works this way, but I have to physically use my inner voice to tell my brain to work on the problem. I think subconsciously it is the permission switch that allows my brain to operate while I'm sleeping, but I've never hooked my brain to electrodes, so I don't know. This sounds crazy, but I will tell you that I'm better than a 50% success rate in solving problems this way. By that, I mean I've contemplated the problem in my wakeful hours and simply can't seem to figure out a way through it. But on the mornings that I wake up with clarity, and occasionally I have the breakthrough that simply astounds me. And while it sounds simply silly and implausible, I'm convinced that it works, and I have used it on several occasions. So one might say, give me an example. Okay, something stupid, but real, so I'll share it, and something you can relate to if you've listened to the podcast. I was working on my hive stand design. The original concept was to be made from wood. I had wood in the garage, and I started cutting 4x4s, and I was going to engineer a masterpiece. One of my design considerations was to make the hive stand lilt a little forward so that the ground would be level, but the hive would tilt forward ever so slightly. To that end, I sketched out some designs. I cut some wood posts for practice, captured dimensions of how to cut the angles on the bottom of the legs of the stand so it would have the right posture, but it made things unsquared and cutting got complicated. So let me make sure everybody's following along. If you set a hive perfectly level, the possibility that the rain hits the entrance, and if it's not right, can run inside on a solid bottom board and collect. So you always want to have the hive tilt forward a little bit. If you cut your legs, all four of them, the exact same length, the hive will be level. And then you have to do something to prop the hive up so that it has that little bit of a tilt. In this case, I was trying to cut the legs shorter in the front, but it required you to cut them at an angle to get the thing. Yeah, it became complicated. So I over-engineered it, and I was frustrated at something that should have been simple. The design was bothering me, but actually, I'm not the greatest woodworker, and perhaps my prototypes didn't have the fit and finish that I wanted. And I also wanted to overlap the wood and design the cuts, and it was just baffling me. I was struggling. So I worked on this for several sessions in the garage, making gains, but it was still far from what I wanted. I went to sleep one night after futzing in the garage and asked my brain to consider the options. Should I switch the design was the question I asked it. Was there some easier way to do this? Consider the fact that while I can, I don't like woodworking. Brain, consider the options and tell me in the morning. I woke up in the morning and had the vision of my PVC hive design. When I say I had the design, I mean the whole design. How to engineer the sides, how to build the three-way fittings, how to design it with the cradle to nest the hive, the whole design as it looks for the most part today. I changed one thing after that in the support under the hive, but I would call it a tweak and nothing more than that. I woke up that morning, went downstairs, took out a piece of paper, and sketched the whole thing out. It was like The Matrix, where she asked Tank to upload the program so that she could fly the helicopter. I promise you, I had never considered the PVC design prior to that night. I hadn't built anything out of PVC. It was simply an epiphany that my sleeping self came up with. Yeah, that's kind of weird, isn't it? I know, and I loved it. It was the power. It's cool. Yeah, Kevin moment. You know, why don't I ask it to make me rich, solve the problem for world hunger or something? I might have to consider that. But actually, I don't think it works that way. It has to be a reasonably defined problem with some evaluation and input, is my suspicion. You can't just say, solve world hunger. It doesn't work that way. End of Kevin moment. So to that end, somewhere in the nether regions, there had to be a morsel. Prior to this, I think I told myself while fixing a PVC fitting for the house that, you know, this stuff, PVC, is pretty easy to work with. Easy to cut, lasts forever, readily available fittings in all kinds of shapes and sizes, and well, someday it might be interesting to consider building something out of this. That was years ago when I was working on the downstairs bathroom when we first bought the house. And at the time, I was considering how to build a chicken coop out in the yard. And well, I ended up building that thing out of wood. But I'm guessing somewhere along the line, I must have nested the option about putting something together in PVC. And that's the only recollection I ever have of considering building anything out of PVC. Okay, I had to share that with you, love it or leave it, to share the new notion that I woke with at 3:30 a.m. the other night. I said I woke thinking about work, and oftentimes to distract my brain and calm it down, I try to shut off, running through work challenges by thinking about beekeeping. You know, it's my chosen distraction that if I find myself in bed and I can't go to sleep, I figure I might as well mull over things I want to be doing instead of crap from work. On this particular night, I started to go through the split I made on Easter Sunday and reviewing if it was done well and thinking back, did I make the same mistakes as last year? I made the split and I gave the hive extra bees and now I'm wondering if it was enough. I have to go out and check on them and make sure that they are hanging in. And of course I did that. As you heard in the local hive report, that was the 8-frame hive, which I did end up adding more bees to. So that got me to thinking philosophically, what the heck am I doing? Am I doing the right thing? And my second notion that I'm going to share with you came to mind. I sometimes try to get perspective on things with the notion that, what if I were watching myself from outer space? No, this isn't a godlike thing. That's not what I mean. I mean, literally, just 50,000 foot view is what I'm kind of alluding to. If I could watch with the slightest bit of interest what I was doing, would I be yelling at myself or happy with my actions? Would I be saying, you idiot, how could you be so dumb? If one allows oneself to disassociate from the here and now, what would your instincts say about the direction you're going in? Would that little voice tell you, you know better, or you should be doing this and you know it? Would it say, you know that hasn't worked in the past, so why are you doing it again? Or stay the course, this is the right path, and you know it is. So maybe it's the time of year, as I seem to get in a reflective mood every year at this time and try to step back and take the view from outer space. In life, where I am, what I'm doing, where I'm heading, personally, at work, in my relationships, my career, beekeeping, with my family, what does it look like from space? It's an interesting view of the world. Question, do you do this? Do you do this? Do you ever step back and look at your life, take stock from the view from space? When it comes to beekeeping, I didn't have much more to say other than I had my goals this year and my view from space is my compass. I went out at dusk on Easter night and worked to level a bit of ground in a corner of my property that is on the other end of my property where I kept my bees. The view from space has always been dissatisfied at where I kept my bees on my property and telling me that the area that I cleared, that I talked about in the local hive report, is better suited because it gets the morning sun and better than where I currently have my bees. It also has a little better access for me and perhaps better protection from the wind than my current location. I've known it all along and simply passed a threshold where I'm going to build into the agenda to set up the new location and move the bees. And that's what I did. As I look down from space, I see a simplification of my efforts. It's been a drag to go over to the farm. I like the property and all the reasons that I went there, but I hate trying to figure out how to cut the grass, forgetting things, and having to come back home. And honestly, the constant contact with my bees. I miss that aspect of it from them being so far away. They seem too far away, and I wanted to have more hands-on. I feel from a management standpoint, the drudgery of having to plan to simply go over there is wearing on me, and my view from space is telling me simply bring them back home. One thing has changed my fortunes and it opened that option, and it's that the farmer next to me has foregone planting his entire field of corn last year. I don't know why. He only planted half the field and left the other half alone, which, as I said before, resulted in very welcome forage for my bees. And I think it simply has turned around things for my property as far as being viable for bees. I keep telling myself I'm going to call him before he gets in and starts cutting that fields. And I've asked him of his intentions, and I know he's pro beekeeping, and so are the landowners. And so my bet is I could persuade him to leave it the way it was, meaning half the field, and even hope that he could sweeten the deal by asking him maybe to plant some clover for me. So time will tell if my view from space read this well. So this has been an unusual segment, but it tells you a little bit about me. I'll end it with a Kevin moment and something that's oddly related that I might have shared, but it's something that has been one of the favorite memories of my father. My dad worked as a bricklayer all his life, and to this day he still helps people with patios and fireplaces when he's not working on his new Chevy S10 hot rod pickup with a motor so large that he had to cut the firewall out to get it in there. He's a very practical person and spoke of work, family, chores, loves to go fishing, and as such has never ventured much into the philosophical ways, which is why what I'm about to tell you stuck and is so out of character from him. His notion was that if aliens visited the planet, they would think the cars inhabit the Earth. I always loved the ingenuity of that thought. End of Kevin moment. For more information on the topic of solving problems while you sleep, consider searching for Solving Problems with the Subconscious Mind. For fun, I put an example link in the show notes of an example of a way to get your brain to work on a problem from a website called creativethinking.net. Roundtable number one, be free honey. H-O-N-E-E. No, that's not a spelling error. It's a story out of the Washington Post lifestyle food section about a little vegan honey company that is now doing something interesting to give back to the bees in a very unorthodox way. A person who works at the Whole Foods Market Bakehouse in St. Paul, Minnesota, her name is Katie Sanchez, was thinking about making a recipe. And as she was experimenting, she wanted to make a pie or some apple butter and decided at the last minute to try and make apple jelly. And she put all the ingredients together, and she could tell towards the end that this was not going to be apple jelly the way she wanted to. But by serendipity, when she got done, she tried to figure out if she could use whatever she made the following day. And when she looked at the result, it uncannily tasted like honey. And unlike honey substitutes that people try to make for, say, vegans, this one really tasted like honey, apparently. It had the same viscosity and mouthfeel and texture and taste and became a pseudo-honey. What a discovery. So think about vegans. They don't use honey because, well, my understanding is they don't want to exploit the work of the bees. But I'm sure that, like everybody else, they would enjoy honey. And so this concoction, which did not come as a product of animal cruelty, is, to some extent, an option for them. And she figured out how to create this concoction and sell it as a product for that market, but apparently you don't have to be a vegan to enjoy it, which is pretty interesting. It makes me want to go to Whole Foods and see if I can get some and taste it to see how close it is to the real thing. So in an interesting twist of fate, part of the marketing routine is to sell this in relief of the bees. For she knew of the problems of CCD and surmised that perhaps she could help the bees by selling honey and therefore relieving bees of having to produce honey and have people over farm honey from bees. It's a bit of a unusual take on things, but the fact of the matter is for all the product that she sells, she makes donations back to beekeepers and does indeed give back to the beekeeping community. So their business is a lot like the little engine that could. The first year they kind of broke even. The second year they made a little bit of money. And the third year they're finally starting to turn a profit and moved into a warehouse and are looking to market a full-fledged product. They're doing it with cooperation of Whole Foods and one of their apparently local producer loan programs. And took it as far as going to a 2016 appearance on Shark Tank. And Barbara Corcoran, Mark Cuban, and Chris Sacca provided them information for refocusing And I don't know if they... Well, actually, it looks like they got $210,000 in financial support out of that. So they convinced the sharks. So part of the undertone of the message is it takes 10 to 60,000 bees to make a pound of honey. And if we take the honey, we end up feeding them sugar water, and that's not healthy for them. So if we can leave them the honey, then perhaps the bees will be healthier. I don't know if that's a rationalization or what, but still, and it's an interesting approach. And if they're willing to give back to honeybees, well, where's the harm in that? So I don't want to drain the entire article. I can provide a link. You can go read the backstory and more information about what they're doing and even more for beekeeping that I didn't cover. But what I did want to say is there was an exciting piece in there that I thought was fun. There's a recipe on there of something that looks a lot like a Nutrigain bar. And I've always wondered how you make that soft crust and to get the taste of that. And so 3 cups of almond flour or almond meal, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 1/4 cup coconut oil liquefied, 1/4 cup bee-free honey. Actually, you could put regular honey in, and guess what? I'm going to do that. 1 tablespoon plus 2 teaspoons vanilla extract, 1 package cup dried figs stemmed, 1/4 cup apple juice or fresh lemon juice from 2 lemons, and 1 teaspoon of finely grated lemon zest is the recipe. To put it all together, you combine the almond flour, salt, coconut oil, honey, or honey, H-O-N-E-E, and 1 tablespoon of vanilla extract in a food processor. Process for 30 seconds to a minute. You'll get clumps of dough to form and stick together when pinched. And it says in there specifically that it's not going to make a ball. Divide the dough in half. Place each on a sheet of plastic wrap. Shape it into 4-inch squares and wrap it tightly and refrigerate it for 30 minutes until firm. And my premise of this, apparently, is you're doing this so you can make a sandwich with the filling, and it has to be cold so you can spread the filling. So you take the dried figs after you clean the bowl out and put them in the food processor. Pulse them until they're coarsely chopped. Add the apple and lemon juice, lemon zest, the rest of the vanilla extract, and process it until it's a paste. And then you let it sit at room temperature until you're ready to bake. So you take the dough, cutting it in half, 2 equal rectangles between sheets of parchment, and roll out to a very thin rectangle that's 5 inches by 9.5 inches. You remove the top parchment and then spread the filling down the middle of the rolled out rectangle. It says to use an offset spatula to spread 1/4 of the filling lengthwise down the middle of the rolled out rectangle so that the strip of the filling is about 2 inches wide with 1.5-inch margin on either side. And the filling should extend all the way to the top and bottom edges, no margin. In essence, what you're going to end up doing, I think, is fold these over, and then they'll overlap slightly at the center, and you use your fingers gently to press the seam, sealing it. And you're only going to seal the edges. You'll leave the ends open, if you've ever seen a Nutrigain bar. You do that with the remaining dough and filling, and then you bake 1 sheet at a time, middle rack, for 13 to 15 minutes until it's golden brown around the edges. Let it cool for 10 minutes. Transfer it to a wire rack and cool. If you've ever seen a Nutrigain bar, that's what these things look like in the photo, and I'm interested in trying it out. And it sounds like a pretty yummy snack, if you ask me. We'll have a link to the article about the bee-free honey and this recipe in the Washington Post in our show notes. Roundtable number 2 called this one industrious. So Saturday, Sharon and I went through a significant number of chores. We were out and about, and I stopped at Home Depot to pick up some things. And one of the things I had on my to-do list was I wanted to build a swarm catcher and also wanted to see if I could get my vacuum put together. So I bought the parts and pieces for it with anticipation that today I would build it. Well, as it so happens, at 8 o'clock in the morning, a neighbor friend of ours, who keeps bees,
called and indicated that she had a swarm in the tree and wanted to know if I would be able to help her in some way, if I had some way to get it down. She put a ladder up against the tree and went up and cut a couple branches down, ones that she could get, but when she put it in the box, all the bees flew back up, so she didn't get the queen. So as it was, I was planning to build my swarm pole capture device and had bought all the parts and pieces yesterday. So this morning, first thing, I put it all together with 5-minute epoxy and a paint roller handle, but I didn't have the pole to go with it. I have a couple tree cutting poles, but none that would extend the way that I needed. Went to Home Depot, they didn't have what I needed, so I ended up running over to Lowe's and bought a paint extension pole. I think it goes to 25 feet. The one Bob Kloss has is all fiberglass. This one was fiberglass around the outside with two aluminum poles, which made me a little nervous, and for a good reason. So I came home with the tools, put it all together, drove over to their house, and she wasn't home. She went somewhere to visit her mother, I think. But I was able to go down and shoot a little video, and I hit that swarm absolutely perfect. First shot up underneath, captured probably 3/4 of the bees, went back the second time and got so many of them and dumped it into the box, and it couldn't have gone any better. The swarm pole was the perfect height for it. So aluminum, yeah. Unfortunately, I bent it on the first go-round, just enough to put a little tweak in it, because when you lower the bees, all the weight of the bees extends across that pole, and the pole had a little banana in it. I was able to straighten it out a little bit, but my concern is that I really needed one of those fiberglass poles, three sections. This is fiberglass on the bottom and aluminum for the top two. I think they do that for weight, but for our purposes of beekeeping, it's probably not right. So I'll keep my eye out for a different pole, but actually for the maiden voyage of the device, it works spectacular. I was happy that I had, you'll find this amusing, Sharon and I have been collecting coins since we got married, and we were talking about going on vacation this year, and we're doing something special. We decided to go to a concert. We're going to a 2-day concert, and the Doobie Brothers are playing, and Journey is playing, and the Eagles, which I always wanted to see, and a couple other bands, Fleetwood Mac, one of Sharon's favorites. So we decided to cash in. Well, I took the plastic jug, dumped all the coins out, and then made the jug into the device. So it's a win-win. It's a great jug because it doesn't have one of those handhelds built in. It's just round all the way around, which no bees get caught in. So it's the perfect jug for using it. So inspired, and since I had my Dremel Multimax out, I also started working on my swarm vacuum. I cut all the holes out of the plastic and started to use 2-part epoxy to put the screen in and get that set up. Unfortunately, I didn't get that finished, but I'm pretty close. And I have to say, I'm not a fan of 2-part epoxy. I never really used it, but stuff smells, and you know, I don't try not to get it on my fingers, but I got it on my fingers, and now my fingers have that stuff. Oh, it's terrible. Bad, bad, bad. I got to use gloves next time. I don't have much experience with it, but I won't make that mistake again. So, yeah. I now have a swarm capture pole, and I don't have to borrow Bob's, as I have the past 2 or 3 seasons. I feel guilty asking him every time I want to use it. And I'm looking forward to someone calling and saying they have swarms for me to capture, because it is the season. And I have started the swarm report. We're starting to see swarms, as I've said, in New Jersey. So life is good. What a great spring we're having for bees. It's going to be really hot this week, and I think for sure we're going to have a lot of swarms. So I have a couple other projects for beekeeping on. And one of the key things is I want to get my Waray hive. And I'm sitting here in the garage looking at some of my equipment. And I want to get the garden hive going and a couple others. So still at a poverty of bees. But, you know, with the nukes that we made this week, anticipating that I'll be able to populated some of this equipment and get it out of my garage where it doesn't belong. So got to use the Queen Castle this week. That's cool. And that was a past Industrious project. And yeah, it's fun when you get to build these things and then actually put them to use. All right. Next roundtable.
Time to head off into the back part of the episode. Roundtable number one, ag is good. Contrary to what we hear most often, a new study from the University of Tennessee is reporting perhaps agriculture may not be as bad as we think it is. In a study titled Agricultural Landscape and Pesticide Effects on Honeybee Biological Traits, which was published in a recent issue of the Journal of Economic Entomology, they evaluated the impacts of row crop agriculture, including the traditional use of pesticides, on honeybee health. Before I share what they have to say, the paper was authored by several from the University of Tennessee, but there are other credits, co-authors, I guess. Participants from the USDA ARS lab in Tucson, Arizona, and NC State's David Tarpey, whom we all know well enough if you've been around beekeeping circles. The reason I mention this is one of the first comments I read after reading the News Journal article about it was, who's paying for the research and what kind of troll is shilling big ag? So over the course of a year-long study, colonies were monitored for performance and productivity by measuring colony weight, brood production, and colony thermoregulation, or how they could keep the colony warm. The outcome, quote, landscape composition significantly affected honeybee colony performance and development. Colony weight and brood production were significantly greater in ag areas compared to the non-agricultural areas, end quote. In the study, they placed 16 different hives in 4 different agricultural areas. And what they determined is that the hives in the vicinity of managed agricultural areas had better thermoregulation, given they had access to more resources and therefore more bees, because the resources were better. The trade-off, it appears, is that they found more traces of pesticides in the pollen in the ag-located hives, but it was reported to be relatively low compared to the acute toxicity of what was in the pollen. In the end, the report summarized with this statement, quote, our study indicates that agricultural crops provide a valuable resource for honeybee colonies, but there's a trade-off with an increased risk of exposure to pesticides, end quote. So that's an interesting take on the world. The risk of possible exposure to pesticides by putting hives in specific ag areas is worth it, given the resources available to the hives and the fact that they can grow bigger and stronger and therefore have better colony weight, better brood production, and colony thermoregulation. Interesting notion. I'll provide a link in the show notes to the journal article and also the news story that I came across on this. My, look at the time. You know what? I had another topic, but it's going to make this episode run a little long, so I think I'll just wrap it up and close it out here. I wanted to share a thank you to those who subscribe to the YouTube channel. We've reached our goal. We had enough subscribers, and enough time has passed that you can go to youtube.com/bkcorner and get to our channel. That's good news. Now all I have to do is find time to produce a video, and I have one in the queue that I should be posting out there soon. In the meantime, I'll recommend that you go check out the one we posted at Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association with Dave Waldman, talking about the Swenty CO2 mite count device. It's youtube.com/NWNJBA. As always, I just want to say thanks to those who donated. I had a couple donations recently. And if you have any questions, comments, send me a note. Kevin@bkcorner.org is my email address. That's going to wrap it up. Time to sign off. I'll say, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.